We're just glad to have Mark here from Phoenix and to share with us today one of the incredible chapters of Core 52. And so let's give an incredible Crossroads welcome to our friend Mark Moore. There we go. Got the standing O.
Yeah. Hey, thanks for having me out at Kokomo, Indiana. I'm actually really excited to be here. What a difference between Phoenix, Arizona. When I left yesterday, it was 80 degrees, but it was rainy, and here it's sunny and not 80 degrees. But I learned something about Kokomo. Chris told me something I never knew before. You are the home of the invention, anyone know? Of the automobile. Yeah, so thank you for that. I'm pretty appreciative. But there's another similarity between your church and ours. And you might not realize this because Chris mentioned we have 35,000 people on a weekend. It's stupid. And I promise you, like, we're not that good. So I don't know why they keep coming, but I didn't share this with 9 o'clock because I like you better. And we baptized over 4,000 people last year. And don't clap too much. I'm not even sure they're all Christians. But there was one woman that came at Easter. I kid you not. Have you seen those little dogs, like they're support animals? She comes to get baptized, ask if we would baptize her dog as well. We said no. So she hands the dog to one of the youth pastors there, and when she gets baptized, he raises the dog up in the baptistry. It was weird. And so she takes now our baptistry is outdoor because we can, and it's about half the size of your stage. It's a big baptistry, and there's lines of people get baptized. So she takes the dog over to the edge of the baptistry. I'm not making this up. She goes, and baptized her dog in our baptistry. So, I mean, we didn't authorize it, but we counted two baptisms for the one dog because it got four legs. We just figured, why not? No, we didn't do that. But, I mean, that's the nature of our church. What I love about our church is that we are a church for the unchurched. And sometimes non-Christians are more comfortable in our church than Christians are. That's the similarity here. I know Chris's heart. I've known him for 20 years. He is excited about the one lost sheep, even over the 99. And I think that's his DNA is in you. I see that on the North Campus. I even hear stories of people who are online joining us. Welcome. And I see it in your faces. We're going to talk more about that through the message. But to illustrate why I wrote Core 52, I wrote it for a guy named Jeff. I mean, not just for him. But Jeff is a dude in our church. His chest is about this big around. A bald-headed, hence gorgeous. And he's an atheist. And Jeff came up to me and goes, you got to talk me into God. Like real aggressive. It kind of frightened me, actually. And I'm going, no, I don't. No, you got to talk me into God. I said, look, Jeff, God's a big boy. If he wants to talk himself into you, he can. That's not my job. And Jeff goes, no, you got to talk me into God. I said, why? Well, because I'm an atheist. So? Well, I want to keep coming to CCV. I like coming to this church. His kids came, his wife came, and he goes, I like coming to this church, and I'm an atheist. I said, well, there's a lot of people from a lot of different faith perspectives, some with no faith who come here. You're welcome to keep coming. He goes, no, you don't get it. In the last month, I've invited 5 of my neighbors to come to CCV. They've all gotten baptized. I feel like a hypocrite. All right, when you got atheists feeling like hypocrites because they keep inviting people to your church, you're in the right church, right? Now, we're screwed up. Don't get me wrong. We're really screwed up. But I thought, here's a guy named Jeff who he needs Bible engagement because we know this. We're not guessing. We know this scientifically that the number one tool or discipline for spiritual growth is Bible engagement. More than prayer. More than baptism, more than church attendance. Folks who read the Bible on their own 4 days a week or more, and that's kind of the magic number, they're called Bible engaged. Bible engaged people compared to everyone else has a much better life. So, for example, Bible engaged people have 60% less drunkenness, 58% less use of pornography, 45% addiction to gambling, 30% higher self-esteem, 30% higher sense of connectedness, 30% less self-destructive thoughts. So it's not just the legalism of the Bible saying you got to be better. No, it's saying you are better because you are a child of God. Now, listen, if you're not a Christian here today, you know you're welcome around this place. We prioritize you, in fact. But you need to know, if you're not a Christian, you should still be reading the Bible 4 days a week or more, whether you believe it or not, because believe it or not, it will make you a better human being. And so I thought, okay, I spent 22 years in a Christian college teaching the Bible. So, like, I'm the dude that gets into the weird, like, stuff that nobody else is interested in. I'm going to prove that in a minute. But because we're talking about Son of Man, who cares? I do. And you are going to by the end of the hour. But nonetheless, how do you get people engaged in the Bible who are not familiar with all the ins and outs? Because it is a big book, right? And it's an old book. So it's easy to get lost along the way. And I'm not going to ask you to raise your hands because I don't want anybody to feel uncomfortable. But if you have ever tried to read the Bible through in a year, like I tried that year after year, and I failed most of the time. Here's why. Genesis, you start Genesis in January, and it goes really good because creation, that's cool. Noah's flood, it's all right. You read Abraham's family, and you go, his family's more screwed up than mine. That's encouraging. And so you go through, January's fine. But then come February, what do you get into? Leviticus. You know that was your outside voice, right? Yeah. No, I get it. It's like, why are you tearing up all those animals? You know, the animal rights people are just like, I'm done. And so how do you get people past the difficult portions of the Bible? I don't know why no one's ever thought of it. I don't even know why I thought of it, but have you heard of the Pareto principle? If you're in business, you probably have. It's called the 80-20 principle, or the principle of the vital few. It's a rule in life that applies to, I don't care whether you're in athletics or business or education, 80% of the gains you get from any endeavor, 80% of the gains you get are from 20% of the efforts. So if you're a student, you need to figure out what 20% of your study is going to get you an A, because that's what gets you an A. If you're an athlete, you got 20% of your players scoring 80% of the points. If you're in business, 20% of your product is giving you 80% of your margin. And I thought, what if we did that for the Bible? What if you don't need to read all of Leviticus or Malachi or Uzbekistan or whatever else is in here? What if I could show you those core verses that take you further, faster in your faith? So that's the purpose of Core 52. And one of those core verses is on the Son of Man. And Chris has asked me to talk about this. And I thought, okay, Son of Man, how are we going to make this relevant? And then Friday came. On Friday, a friend of mine, his name is Jason, Jason, first of all, you need to know, he is the fourth largest producer of body armor in the world. So he's got this huge company, multi-millions of dollars of product every year. He has over 2,000 patents on equipment that have saved our men and women in the military forces. And he thought, in order to get better, he is going to bring in a teacher who teaches all of our Delta Force operators in the Army. Now, if you don't know, Delta Force is like what the Navy SEALs are. Only they would say they're better. You let them debate that. They're guys who are literally one of these operators is worth 1,000 enemies. That's usually the stats of the ratios. And he is the trainer for all of the Delta operators in the area of shooting. So he is a 5-time world champion shooter, not target practice. This is shooting on the run with multiple weapons at your hand. So in other words, he could kill all of us in this room before any of us got out of our seat. I mean, he is that skilled. And so I have an opportunity. There's three of us in the room, Jason, my friend, and on the other side of me is Larry Fraley. He's our mission pastor. He's over a $6 million budget going over all over the world, and I'm a teaching pastor. Why would he train us? because his training was not how to shoot guns. His training was mental preparation before you shoot guns. Literally, envisioning every scenario that you're going to encounter. So believe it or not, I put his training into practice before I stood on this stage. I've already preached this sermon in my mind to you, which is different than the first hour. Like, I went through it in my head. I went through the movements and how I'm going to hold my Bible. I was like, is this making sense to you? It doesn't matter whether you're a gymnast or in a business meeting. It doesn't matter if you're in the military or the ministry. This skill is an important skill of training your mind. So that was the training I was getting. Okay, all of that to say, he introduces himself to us. His name is Jason also. He said, hi, I'm Jason. I've won a few competitions in shooting, and I want to tell you how I prepared for those competitions. That was his introduction. And my buddy Jason goes, oh, okay, hold up. Hold up a second. When he says he's won a few competitions, he is a 5-time world champion who trains all of the Delta Force operators. And I'm going, this guy, talk about underselling yourself. And I was so, like, stunned at his humility. And then he turned to me and to Larry and said, why don't you guys introduce yourself? I'm sitting here. This is embarrassing to admit, so please don't judge me, okay? I'm sitting here stunned by his humility, and when he asked about me to introduce myself, I said, well, I'm the teaching pastor of the fifth largest church in the nation, and I speak to 35,000 people. And as soon as it came out of my mouth, I said, what a moron. I should have said, I'm a communicator. I speak to people in churches. See, I knew better. And here's what's embarrassing. I did it out of habit. I habitually oversell myself. Why? If you do that too, if you're going, yep, that's me, I can tell you why, because I know why, because I'm the same way. Because you're insecure. I don't care what level of title you have, from CEO to a general, I don't care what title you have, I don't care what physical physique you have, I don't care how much money you make. If you oversell yourself, it is out of an insecurity. And that's why, son of man, whether you're a Christian, a pre-Christian, a post-Christian, why this theology matters to you. It'll make you better no matter who you are. So can we talk about son of man? Is that okay? Son of man, it's a simple phrase that you might recognize from the life of Jesus that actually comes from the Old Testament. Did you know that? If you go to the Old Testament, it is found 107 times in the Old Testament. 93 of those are in one book. The book of Ezekiel, which is, no more comments from you, okay? Just, I know it's one of those, Ezekiel. It's one of the longest books, and it's all the repetition. Ezekiel is the only person in Ezekiel called Son of Man. And you know who calls him Son of Man? God. And it's not a compliment. No, what God is saying is, I'm God, you are not. I am God, you are Son of Man. Now, you may be called son of something else, but that is an insult. Son of Man is saying, you are human, I am divine. You have warts, you have pimples, you're fallible. I am not. That's what it means. Now, it's not exactly an insult. It's kind of like when we just call someone son. Hey, son, I'm not insulting you. I am putting you in your place. I'm the dad, you're the son, or I'm the boss, you're the son. And so it's not necessarily an insult, unless you're rednecker than I am, but I don't know about that. My wife listens to country music, I apologize. It is a sign for Ezekiel that I'm putting you in your place. So all 107 uses are putting you in your place, except for one. There's one that is an outlier, and it is weird. In fact, it comes out of a weird book, Daniel. You ever read that? I mean, the lion's den, that's a cool story, but there's some weird stuff in there. Here's what Daniel encounters. He has this vision, and in his vision, he sees God on his throne. And he describes him in some detail. But then he sees an odd thing with God. Now remember, Ezekiel is Son of Man. He's down here. But then he goes to the Son of Man, who is up there. So let's read Daniel chapter 7, verse 13. I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like a Son of Man. And he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And if you're reading this with Ezekiel in mind, you have to say, how in the world did a Son of Man get way up there? Son of Man is supposed to be down here. And then it goes on, if I could read verse 14, this Son of Man was given authority, honor, and sovereignty over all the nations of the world, so that peoples of every race, nation, and language would obey him. His rule is eternal. It will never end. His kingdom will never be destroyed. Now, because you're New Testament people, you go, oh, well, that's Jesus. Yeah, I get it. Daniel had no clue. This is a conundrum for him. How in the world can a Son of Man down here be up there with God? How can a Son of Man rule over the nations? How can a Son of Man have an eternal kingdom? And the answer to that question comes when we turn to the New Testament. Because that same phrase, Son of Man, Son of Man, Son of Man, is used 107 times in the Old Testament, 85 times in the New Testament. Now, you can say this out loud if you like. Who does it refer to in the New Testament? Jesus, thank you. Who else does it refer to in the New Testament? That's correct. No one. Who calls Jesus Son of Man? Jesus. Who else calls Jesus Son of Man? That's correct. No one. It's like, if Jesus, no one would dare use a earthly designation for Jesus but Jesus. And this is kind of like weird. Why would Jesus associate himself with a lowly, not an insult, but a lowly name when he was an exalted Son of God? Like, I just tell you, I mean, you already know this because I admitted it. If I were Jesus, I'd walk around going, hey, Messiah, hey, healer, that great physician, Son of God, not Son of Man. Son of God, not Son of Man. So the question is, why? Why does Jesus give himself a title that no one else dares give him that is so humble? Because he knew the rule. And if you're going to succeed in life, particularly in your spiritual life, you need to know the rule. There is a rule of honor that comes from God. God's rule for honor comes, and this is a quote from Jesus, but it's all over the Bible. But here's what Jesus says. Here's the rule. Next verse. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. That's the rule. What is it, rule for Christians? No, it's a rule. Like for who? For everyone. Does it mean that God is going to, if you humble yourself, God will exalt you? Yes, whether you're a Christian or not. Because God executes his exaltation and humiliation often through human agents. Don't you see this in business? Those who exalt themselves often get destroyed. Don't you see it with athletes? Those who exalt themselves get destroyed. Don't you see this with pastors? Those who exalt themselves often get destroyed. This is just the rule of life. So let me show you how Jesus applied the rule to himself. If you go to Mark chapter 2, he has this encounter where four men let a paralytic through the roof. And before Jesus heals the paralytic, he says, your sins are forgiven. You should have been there. The Pharisees blew a gasket. It's like, you can't forgive. Only God can forgive sins. Look, if you hurt me, if you offend me, I can forgive you for your offense against me. I can't forgive you your offense against God. Like if we're in a traffic accident, you hit my car. I can say, hey, like, don't worry about it. I'll pay for the damages. I can say that. But the police officer is still writing you a ticket. I can't make him stop writing you a ticket. You understand the concept? But Jesus, on behalf of Yahweh, is forgiving sin. And here's what Jesus says about himself. but that you may know that the, what is it, Son of Man has authority to forgive sins. So he takes this earthly title and he applies it. He's going, like, I'm God. Yeah, I forgive like God. I am Son of Man. Later in the chapter, verse 28, you got this whole Sabbath discussion. The Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. Time out. I mean, like, if you're wearing a yarmulke right now, you're going, whoa, 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 whoa. Lord of the Sabbath? Listen, the Sabbath is not a Mosaic law. Now, it is in the Ten Commandments, but it's way older than that. This goes back to the Garden of Eden. It is the principle of rest. It doesn't matter if you're Jewish or Christian or Muslim or atheist. The principle of rest applies to you. That if you don't rest, God will take it out in one lump sum at the end of your life. That's the rule. And Jesus is saying, you know who is Lord of that rule? Moi. I am Yahweh God, but my title here is Son of Man. There's another passage, Matthew chapter 16. For the Son of Man is going to come with his angels in the glory of his Father, and he will repay each person according to what he has done. So what's Jesus claiming here? I'm the judge. At the end of time, I will judge the world. At the beginning of time, I created the rest principle. In the middle of time, I can forgive people's sins. At the end of time, I will judge the world. And all those times, he said, I'm the Son of Man. Isn't that extraordinary? He could have said, I'm the world champion. I'm the savior of the world. I'm this, but he does. He says, I am Son of Man. And you know what he means by that because of the last use of Son of Man in the gospel. This comes out of Mark in chapter 14. He is before Caiaphas. He's on trial. And Caiaphas says, are you the Messiah? And he says, I am. And you will see, now pay attention here. What is Jesus alluding to? You will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven. That is as close to a quote as you get of Daniel 7:13. So he knows it's a title of humiliation, but is also in God's economy a title of exaltation. Why? Because God will exalt those who are humbled and humble those who are exalted. You see how that works? And we see that it worked by one of the most powerful passages in the New Testament describing Jesus. This comes from Philippians chapter 2. Maybe we could read this all together. Would you mind? Therefore, God has highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name that is above every name. Why did God do that? Because Jesus humbled himself. And the rule is, if you humble yourself, God will exalt you. If you exalt yourself, God will humble you. That applies to Jesus. That applies to me. That applies to you. What does that look like in real life? What does that look like? Well, I've already told you that your church and mine have some similarities in prioritizing those who are outside the church so they would be comfortable coming inside the church and meeting Jesus Christ. I've heard some stories. And look, you might look at our church and say, wow, 35,000 people, that's a huge church. Actually, we don't count the number of people who sit in a seat. We count the number of people outside who have a need. So let's just put this in perspective. Our church has 35,000 people in a city of 4.5 million. So we ask, are we big based upon market share, not participants? Does that make sense? You business people, you understand that? Business women, businessmen, you understand that? Our market share is 0.5% in Phoenix. Don't say that we're a big church. We are failing to meet the majority of needs in our community. As a matter of fact, you add all the churches in Phoenix together, we are at about a 15% market share. That is not enough. You know where you are? Kokomo is a community of 50,000 people. Your church has 2,000 people. You are at a 4% market share. Do you understand the power that that gives you to transform this community? And you are actually, factually doing it. And I want to show you how your church, living out the Son of Man principle, is making a practical difference in your community and how God is exalting you because of it. Did you, surely you know about God's garage? Is there just some dude who is retired who goes, you know what? I'm not a big deal. I'm just a mechanic, but I do know how to fix cars. And so, you know, if I could fix cars for a single mom or for a widow, that would be a good thing. So he just started doing it. And because he humbled himself, and listen, this is a distinction that's important. Humility is not how you feel about yourself. It's how you treat other people. Now, in America, we're so self-oriented. We go, I'm not that big a deal. Would you just stop it? One of my college professors, he was one of the best preachers I've ever known. Every time he got off stage, I go, man, that was a great sermon. He go, oh, no, I could have done better. Would you just stop it? You're not humble. You're just a liar. You are good, and you know you're good. Humility is not denying your ability. It is applying your ability to those who have a need. And here you got this mechanic, he knows what he can do, and all he does is just does what he can do in a quiet, humble way for those who have a need. That is biblical humility. And what has happened because of it? A bunch of other dudes around him go, dude, if you can do that, I can do that. He showed a way for others to use their talent. So you got all these volunteers coming in, and then the story gets picked up by an Indianapolis outlet, and all of a sudden it is the number one story of the year. Right here in Kokomo, Indiana, the big city is looking at you. And then, now who cares if other people brag about you? I mean, it's cool, but it doesn't make a difference. But because of that notoriety, some dude in, I think it was Chicago, said, I like what they're doing. I've got a building I'm not using. I'm going to give you a building. I don't even think that guy's a Christian. But he, because he sees the good you're doing, he recognizes it in a tangible way. That is the principle of Son of Man. Listen, Jesus is not the Son of Man, not the only Son of Man. You are too. And you're a daughter of man, and you're a daughter of man, and you're a son. All of us, that's all of our title. And Jesus isn't showing us how to be humble and like, aw, shucks, not me. He's showing us how to use our known abilities to meet a known need. That's extraordinary to me. There's another ministry that I heard about is your ministry of food, like a pantry. And we don't even have one of those in our church, so I applaud you for that. And you're doing such a great job of it that some of you are going, look, I don't want to give leftovers. I don't want to give spare change. I'm going to give a whole hog. In this place, that's literal, not figurative. And you give the best of the meat. And other people are going, like, seriously, you're giving a whole hog? Well, I'm going to give a whole hog too. And it went from 1 to 5 to 30. I don't even know how many hogs there are, but you guys keep giving more hogs. So either you're really good Jews or really good Christians. I don't know which at this point. But because of that, a national grocery chain has looked at you and said, I want to be a, like, they're not Christians doing this. It's a corporation that's saying the church is doing a better job at feeding people who need it most than we are. So we're going to use our resources, and they not only match you dollar for dollar or pound for pound, but sometimes they will give 2 to 1. So everything you donate gets replicated and multiplied. It's kind of like, gosh, I don't know, maybe this is a modern miracle of the feeding of the 5,000. But I commend you and all of your volunteers. Some of you just giving time out of your schedule or after work or maybe in your retirement. You are doing the hands and feet of work of Jesus right here in your community. I'm amazed at you by that. There's another one. This Celebrate Recovery. Now, a lot of churches have Celebrate Recovery. We do too. Very few do what you do. In fact, maybe no one else does fully what you do. Number one, you have a full meal. which is part of the Celebrate Recovery program. I don't know if you know that, but that's their expectation. We could never pull that off. But you're doing it every single week. And a couple of the volunteers, Brad and Brooke, Brad was part of this like men's workout Bible study program, and he just got pulled into it, said, hey, could you volunteer? And Brad and Brooke thought, yeah, we'll go volunteer because we got our lives together, and we're going to go bless these people that have these addictions. Guess who got blessed? Brad and Brooke. And because they are influencers, they begin bringing other people into the circle of volunteers and making a tremendous difference for this community healing. And because of that, like Chris took me through the building last night, I am drooling over the building that was basically given to you. Like $300-some thousand for over $1 million piece of property. That property is a perfect location. It is an amazing, like what God has dropped in your lap is unbelievable by a Christian who would not say he's doing it to make Jesus famous. You know why he's doing it? Because he gets the Son of Man theology. He may not even be a Christian, but he's a good theologian. And he understands. Listen, what God has done by giving you that building is because you have humbled yourself, not by denying your abilities, but by implementing your abilities to meet practical needs. Right here in your midst, I've given you three illustrations of how God is living out the Son of Man theology where you live. There's one more. And I just be real personal with you right now, real transparent. My wife is a pastor's wife. The greatest tension in our marriage is with ministry, because a lot of the ministry, she wants to do ministry with me. And because of the nature of my role, that's not always possible. And so what is she supposed to do? And she's looking at how she can meet the needs of other pastors' wives, but she doesn't really always feel like she is capable enough, competent enough. Like, what if I'm not the senior pastor, I'm the teaching pastor, so would she get in the way of the senior pastor's wife? And so she's really hesitant of calling other women to her. You realize that most of the pastor's wives in your city, they are a single team, man and wife. That's all the staff they have in their church. They are lonely. Pastor's wife is one of the loneliest jobs in the world, and here's why. The husband can come home and, just over dinner, here's the struggles we're going through. If I tell my wife something like some of the junk that's happening, I will get over it in 2 days. She will take 2 years. Because the law of second offense, she's going to be offended for me. A senior pastor's wife knows all the crap of the church and has nobody to talk to about it. And there are, the majority of the pastor wives in your city are living very lonely, difficult, frustrated lives. They need a group of women. And there's one senior pastor's wife that has begun to bring them all together. You probably don't know this, but it is Annette. And she won't even look up here right now because she's embarrassed, because she's just going, and I'm just doing what I can. And I promise you, she doesn't feel qualified to do that, but no one else is doing it. So she just saw a need and said, you know what? I may not be super qualified. I may not be the best person to do it, but I'm the only one that's standing up. And because of her, there are 40 women in this city who have come out of the shadows of loneliness and have a group of women that they can connect with. That to me is an amazing... Like, I know you guys love Chris, and he gets all the attention, but really, you should feel lucky to have Annette. I'm just saying. She is a jewel of this church, and she's not the only one. I mean, I've now told you four stories about yourself. You should be proud as a church. And this should cause every person in every seat, online, at the North Campus, and right here in the room, every person should be asking the question, what am I doing for God's sake on this earth? We have a number of next steps around here. Sometimes it's Bible reading. And sometimes it's giving. And sometimes it's worshiping. but it always at some point for you to go forward in your faith, at some point you have to step out and say, I'm a son of man. I have an ability and I see a need. You don't need permission. You don't need a title. You don't need pay. You need a call of God. And the whole purpose of this message is to let the call of God through the Son of Man hit your heart. So I'm just going to ask you one more time and then pray. What on earth are you doing for God's sake in Kokomo, Indiana? Holy Father, these are salt of the earth people. I know it. This isn't flyover country. This is the heart of the country. And right here in Kokomo, there are so many people that have built cars and made metal. And I pray that there would be a new metal invented here, a titanium heart for your people, an iron will, a steel resolve, that we would be the people of God that are change agents, not for our own name or fame, but to make Jesus famous so that your people could flourish. We pray in Christ's name. Amen.